Jack Curtis loved his P-38 Lightning. He loved flying it in duty over Europe in 1945, and he was thankful for its firepower during a dogfight over Trier, Germany. The air battle was chaos with planes everywhere, friendlies and enemies.
You just really mostly were interested in what's in front of you and what isn't behind you. But I was flying the wing of my squadron commander. And I was interested in keeping anything off of his tail until he ran out of ammunition. And then he flew my wing until I ran out of ammunition. So it was just like the movies.
Curtis says the whole business of keeping track of kills wasn't a priority during a dogfight, but he thinks he got some hits.
Not confirmed. I've got two damages, all I got in that one dogfight. But, you know, you don't wait to see whether they went down. If you got hits and you were going off someplace else and trying to do something else. So I don't know. All I know is that I got two confirmed damaged.
P-38s were more common in the Pacific War because they performed better in warmer weather. Jack Jacobson flew 111 combat missions beginning in Guadalcanal in 1942 until taking part in the mission to kill Imperial Japanese Commander Yamamoto in 1943. He says the P-38 was fast with a top speed of 400 miles per hour and could almost skim the ocean waves or the jungle tops to evade detection. But most of all, Jacobson says it was a lethal flying machine.
Those four 50 caliber machine guns and 20 millimeter cannon in the nose of that P-38 is a vicious gathering of armament. It would cut a hole in an airplane. It would totally destroy anything that it was shooting at.
United States Air Force Academy History Department Chairman Mark Wells says the twin-engine P-38 was a revolutionary machine with self-sealing fuel tanks and cockpit armor.
That had long range and lots of firepower and great speed. It wasn't as maneuverable as any of the Japanese airplanes, particularly the Zero, but perfectly adaptable to the Pacific and saw lots and lots and lots of action. Pilots tend to fall in love with the machine that they're flying, unless it's just a complete dog. I mean, the P-38 guys thought it was a magnificent airplane. Yeah, they were in love. And of course, you see, you know, the names on the side, the young ladies in various stages of dress or undress. And I mean, it's quite colorful. Nose art and the psychology of fighter pilots is a whole topic unto itself.
It took cerebral agility and talent to fly these planes, but Colonel Wells says not all fighter pilots were elite. He did a dissertation on World War II pilots, and one he thought said it best. There were a lot of pilots who flew fighters, but only a few were fighter pilots.
He was talking about this combination of aggressiveness without being reckless. I don't know that any of them that I talked to were bloodthirsty at all, but there was a sense of competition and keenness. Some of them had a real boyish thrill for flying. I mean, kind of the kinetic thrill of just being in control of things. They're very, very quick in terms of mental quickness without necessarily being, you know, a PhD or a genius.
Wells says Imperial Japanese Navy fighter pilots were also a special breed.
The one that almost immediately comes to mind is by a man by the name of Saburo Sakai. And he actually, you know, was in it from the beginning and survived the war, astonishingly enough. To say that these guys were elite is an understatement, particularly the pre-war guys. He describes pre-war training in the extreme, maybe 10 out of 100 who sign up actually getting through the whole regime, but going up, being ordered to go up to a cliff and jump. If they hesitated, they washed out. I mean, just the most severe kind of training. And then they were flying great equipment, the Zero, long range, and they had doctrine and they had experience and they gave us all we could handle.
Imperial Japanese Navy pilot Saburo Sakai was born into a family with samurai ancestry and was the second leading Japanese ace to survive the war. He finished with 60 Allied planes destroyed or damaged, most of them American. His motto was, never give up. Yet he said glorifying war was wrong and became a Buddhist monk after the war. Wells says most fighter pilots didn't shoot down any enemy planes, with 5 to 10% of the group accounting for 50% of the kills in World War II. So the few like Richard Bong, Tommy McGuire, David McCampbell, Gregory Boyington, and Aussie ace Clive Killer Caldwell, who, by the way, hated his nickname, were unique.
So you have a combination of traits that I'm quite sure the Air Force would like to identify and bottle and pass out to everybody.
You're listening to Forever Ace, the Richard Bong story on Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Sortie 5, back in action. During Bong's leave, Tarawa and the Gilbert Islands were taken during Allied landings. The Japanese fortress base of Rabaul was isolated and no longer considered a threat. Allied forces were island-hopping their way to the Central Pacific. They pushed 1,800 miles westward and 700 miles northward toward Japan, but by the summer of 1944, Allied forces were still 2,000 miles away from Tokyo.
Richard Bong wasn't the Hollywood notion of an ace fighter pilot. Fellow pilot Walter Markey says he wasn't the swashbuckling, hard-drinking type.
I remember in one instance where he was trying to live up to the fighter pilot image. He took a shot of whatever it was, whether it was gin or vodka or whatever. How can anybody drink this stuff? almost joked. Being the sophisticated New Yorker I was at the time, he was a country boy. But he was a nice guy, great. Good friend.
Markey says his friend was honest and always true to his word, and he was determined to end the war as soon as possible.
I was on a mission with him. He was leading the flight. We were escorting B-25s over on New Britain. He took the whole formation, told them not to drop their tanks, turned our whole formation, because above the B-25s we were escorting and below us, a Japanese twin-engine transport-type plane was flying. He turned our whole formation on around. He shot one engine out, shot the other engine out, turned the whole formation around, and we caught up with the B-25s. You know, that's the kind of guy he was. So he took advantage of every situation he could. He wasn't a reckless individual, but he took advantage.
But this wasn't just one pilot's war. Markey, like many World War II vets, has his share of harrowing stories.
I knocked down a Japanese airplane on basically a quarter head-on shot, and in rolling to keep him in my sights, I wound up going down with him and in the midst of the Japanese convoy. And I swore it took me half an hour for that destroyer to get off my tail. But that's the adrenaline running.
He says they all came back from missions with bullet holes in their fuselage. Markey says the sound of getting hit was unforgettable.
If you didn't get too many, it was just like a ting, 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 ting. And you turned around, you saw somebody firing at you.
And then what did you do?
Duck.
Staying alive was a day-to-day goal. Wingman Iron Pants Wandry says air combat was fast and intense, but they knew what they had to do and how to do it.
In World War II, a head-on pass was the equivalent of the ultimate game of chicken. The first pilot that turned away was dead. You're coming head-on at someone, he's coming at you. The first one that turns away turns their guns away from that opponent and exposes your belly. You're dead. And I mean literally, this game of chicken was for keeps. I found out that it's a lot more thrilling than a thrill you could do without to watch bullet holes coming up the wing of your plane toward the cockpit.
Wandry says in 1943 they were outnumbered by zeros on every mission. Some of his friends died in action, while other pilots in his group survived, but none were unscathed.
When I got nailed in a 38, the first time some Jap Zero got behind us, we were outnumbered 8-1, I think. And he lobbed a cannon shell into my right wing. That made enough impression on my mind that I decided nobody's ever going to get behind me again. And in the next 220 missions, nobody did.
Back in action, Bong shot down 4 more enemy planes in 2 weeks. He was just one shy of World War I American ace Eddie Rickenbacker's all-time record of 26. Then on April 3, 1944, during a mission over Hollandia, New Guinea, he tied the record. He broke it 9 days later, shooting down three Japanese Oscar fighter planes and damaging two others over Hollandia. Along with Markey and Wandry, Bong's fighter group, dubbed the Flying Circus, had another leading American ace. Captain Tommy Lynch had 20 kills to his credit. Wandry says Bong needed luck and skill to bag that many enemy aircraft.
All of those. He was fortunate in getting into positions, but he was also a good shot. I followed his deal, and I taught all the pilots that I went with it. You shove the guns up their tail and push the trigger, and that way you can't miss. There were several times when we had debris and explosions that we had to fly through. But when Dick saw an airplane, an enemy plane, he was just like a hound dog on the trail of a rabbit. The rest of the world was gone until he got that plane. Flying on somebody's wing like that, there wasn't a lot left to shoot at when he finished.
The war took its toll on the Flying Circus. On March 8th, Captain Tommy Lynch got his 20th kill, but it cost him his life. Markey says in spite of Allied victories, zeros still filled the air. He'll never forget a mission over Wewak, New Guinea on March 19th, 1944.
We were usually outnumbered. I was in combat for a year and a half before I ran into odds of less than 6-1. At one time, I took on 19 Japanese zeros by myself. When I found I was alone, I joined the formation. Instead of just attacking them, I made the standard maneuvers and joined up with them. And the last man signaled me to come in and join them. And they were flying just like the Blue Angels or the Thunderbirds. Well, they were within 2 feet of each other. And the wingtips were overlapping the plane ahead of them. So when I joined up, instead of dropping into formation, I lined up all the canopies and pressed the buttons and held them down until I was out of ammunition, and then I ran for home. And in 1986, I finally made it to Japan, and I went through the Imperial War Museum, and I found out that there were two squadrons of Japanese planes in that formation, a total of 19 planes. And they lost so many planes that they took what was left of both squadrons, put them together to form one, and sent them to the Philippines. 2 weeks later, the commanding general of the Japanese 4th Air Army in the South Pacific was relieved of his command. So here I turned out to be a hero, and I got two probables out of it.
Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto was the architect of the Japanese air attack on Pearl Harbor. For the next year and a half, as commander of the Imperial Japanese Combined Fleet, Yamamoto directed the Pacific Campaign, trying to knock out Allied forces so it couldn't continue the war against Japan. In April 1943, the Allies intercepted and decoded a top-secret Japanese radio message. It was dynamite. It had the exact time and location of Yamamoto's island base hopping trip. He hoped to boost the morale of his forces for another effort to turn back Allied forces in the Mariana and Solomon Islands. The Swift P-38 Lightning was the only plane that could make this long-distance needle-in-a-haystack rendezvous. 16 U.S. Air Corps P-38 pilots were chosen to fly the longest intercept attack in history, 500 miles, with nothing but a compass and a clock as their guide. Jack Jacobson was one of those pilots. He says they knew it was a long shot, but they also knew they could do it. Still, the open ocean didn't have landmarks, and the two-hour mission at very low altitude, just 50 feet off the water, played tricks on a pilot's mind.
You get mesmerized doing that. You know, you keep looking like this. You have a tendency to fly into the water, and you had to keep looking for the guy ahead of you. And, of course, he's looking at the guy ahead of him. And some of them got down, they claimed, low enough that they had ripples in the waves. But we strictly had to go by the compass. There were no rivers, there were no towns, there were no buildings, nothing but open water.
In a 2003 speech at the Bong Heritage Center, Jacobson told the audience that it took some luck, some guessing, and some good planning. Yamamoto's two staff bombers and six Zeros were right on time. He remembers Lieutenant Colonel Doug Canning making the call.
Canning, who was number three right behind me, broke silence and said, "Bogies, 11 o'clock high." I looked up, and sure enough, there's two bombers and six Zeros at 6,000 feet just leaving Empress Augusta Bay. I couldn't believe it. After flying over 2 hours at 50 feet off the water, without any reference whatsoever, to arrive there 1 minute from the scheduled time, and for Yamamoto to leave when he said he would and arrive at Empress Augusta Bay was a miracle.
But Jacobson says Canning and the other pilots had their hands full.
Zeros were chasing him, and he went on and zinked and zagged and tried to get out of the way, and he noticed the bomber that had turned towards the beach. In the meantime, of course, Holmes got rid of his tanks. He made a pass, and he found this bomber over the beach as well, and with his wingman, fired at it, and his bullets went into the water, into the bomber, and then he went on. Barber, as he's pulling away from Yamamoto's bomber, came in behind that same bomber, made an attack on it, and it blew up in his face. Pieces of it hit his gondola, and he actually saw it hit the water. All this, by the way, the entire combat action that I'm speaking about lasted less than 10 minutes. You had two bombers, six Zeros, and four P-38s, all milling around at about 1,000, 2,500 feet. It was a wild melee.
On April 18, 1943, on an inspection tour from Merbau across the Solomon Islands, the Harvard-educated, English-speaking Admiral Yamamoto was killed in the surprise attack. This was considered a great blow to Japanese morale and a great American victory. But none of the people on the mission could talk about it, let alone be recognized for it. The Imperial Navy couldn't know their top-secret code had been cracked. For the men of this mission, Jacobson says it was the end of combat duty.
They decided, just like they did with Richard Bond, brought him home because it was too much notoriety. If any of us that were on the mission were caught as prisoners of war, and they found out we were on the mission, killed their revered leader, we would have been shot.
Jacobson says he was bored with stateside duty until he volunteered as a test pilot for the newest thing in air warfare, the Lockheed MX-409 jet fighter, later known as the P-80 Shooting Star.
Now, Forever Ace, Sortie 6, home to stay.
This is Frank McCarthy, United Press reporting from an advanced Allied base in New Guinea. I'm alive to tell you the story of my 45-minute flight with America's new ace of aces, Major Richard Ira Bond. With my knees propped up around my chin and my heart in my throat, I rode piggyback Friday in the P-38 Iron Steed. It was the most unforgettable 45 minutes of my life. While zooming his twin-engine fighter in the cloudless sky, he gave me just one direction: hang on to your teeth. Indeed, I did hang on with every square inch of skin, while the Major pointed the nose upward in a steep climb and then, I suspect for my benefit, whipped her into a dive. Ostensibly, he told me this was what it was like in aerial combat. We went up, we went down, we executed innumerable immolments, slow rolls by the score, and for good measure, several reverse verticals and barrel rolls, plus one or two old-fashioned loop-de-loops. The airspeed indicator bumped up against the 400-mile-per-hour mark most of the time. I never once dropped below 4 miles per minute as the Major put his iron steed through the paces. Sometimes, I might add, with only 20 feet of sunlit sky between us and the menacing jungle. At intervals, he would glance impishly at me and advise me of the next torturous maneuver he would make. Once, I suppose, to impress me, he cut one engine of his Lightning to prove to me its airworthiness. Much to my horror, he took his hand off the stick and lit a cigarette. After repeated protestations on my part, the good Major restarted the engine. He then asked if I had blacked out during any of these drills. I replied I hadn't, but I rather enjoyed having my insides pulled apart during the aerial acrobatics. Major Bong then casually remarked that he had blacked out several times during the flight. He commented that he is very prone to blacking out,
After noticing the pained expression on my face, he urged me not to fear. Even when blacked out, he says his hands know what to do. This pleasure flight was Bong's first since he was grounded after setting the record. If he's sent home, and every indication is that he will be, he says he'd like to fly a P-38 over Poplar and buzz its main street at 400 miles an hour. This correspondent's advice is to people back in America. Hold on to your filly. At an advanced Allied base in New Guinea, this is Frank McCarthy reporting.
And now back to Chet Huntley with today's I Was There guest, America's top flying ace, Major Richard Bong. And so, Major Bong, in spite of your desire to fly an attack bomber, you were assigned to a fighter.
Yes, Mr. Huntley. Later, I got my overseas assignment and headed for Australia, and from there to New Guinea for my first mission. Well, that's the story. And, of course, I was there.
From Poplar, Wisconsin, comes America's own Major Richard Bong.
Welcome to Furlough Fund, Major. Needless to say, it's a real honor to play host to a top allied ace of the Pacific.
Burl, I'd rather you'd forget that ace business. I'm just an average American guy who was taught to fly fast and try to shoot straight. Get us the plane. Lots of planes, America. And God willing, we'll fly the wings off them for you. Good night, all.
On December 12, 1944, at Lady Island in the Philippines, Allied Pacific Theater Commander General Douglas MacArthur pinned the Congressional Medal of Honor on Major Bong. In fewer than 3 months of combat missions in the Philippines, he destroyed a dozen more enemy planes, bringing his total to 40, the most of any U.S. pilot. Richard Bong was home for good in January 1945. He was ordered home for his own safety, but not necessarily comfort. He had to do what he hated most. War bond drives demanded that he be in the limelight, and worst of all, he had to give radio interviews. Retired Bong Heritage Museum director Christabel Grant says he walked into a beehive of media.
It was very challenging, and Dick undertook to do it because he felt it was part of the job, that the country needed somebody like him to look up to and to say, yes, I'm out there on the front line fighting and defending our country every single day, and we're all taking these huge risks. And I think he just understood that that needed to be said, that the people needed someone to respect and to look up to, and they found, in the true sense of the word, they found a hero.
Grant says it was difficult for both Bong and his new fiancée, Marjorie Vattendall. Neither wanted the spotlight, but they were in it. In a 2002 interview, Marjorie Bong Drucker says he was as famous as 1940s movie stars Jimmy Stewart and Clark Gable.
We'd go to the chefs or someplace like that. You could just see people, you know, looking, and and they'd come and get brave enough to come over and talk and so forth. It was fun.
Christabel Grant became good friends with Marjorie Bong Drucker in 1996. The two remained close until her passing in 2003. She says it wasn't the ace pilot who was glamorous, it was Marjorie.
I can only say that any man worth his salt would have singled her out. She was a beautiful young woman, as you can tell from looking at the picture of her he put on the nose of his plane.
That famous picture on Bong's P-38 Lightning wasn't enough for paparazzi. Marjorie Bong Drucker says once they became engaged during a brief leave in 1944, news photographers couldn't get enough of her. They traveled to her home in Superior to shoot America's ace girlfriend to prove she was what turned out to be the mythical all-American woman.
One picture that I always remember, my mother and I with an open oven door, and I'm taking out this roll of beautiful buns that supposedly I had made. Well, I never knew how to. My mother was a wonderful cook and a baker. I tried my darndest to make it smooth on the top. I never did it. Well, I never disclaimed the fact that it was my mother who did that. And then they would come in and they would take pictures of me playing the piano. Well, I didn't play the piano.
Mm-hmm. Once he was home for good in 1945, the couple wanted to get married right away. But Marjorie says what they wanted didn't matter. The wedding of America's leading ace pilot was a news event too valuable not to exploit. So instead of a January wedding, they would have to wait a couple more weeks. At Concordia Lutheran Church in Superior, on February 10, 1945, they were married, and married, and married.
Unbelievable. We didn't have a thing to do with it. I mean, everything was planned, you know, down to the 1,200 people that were invited. Anderson's Bakery over in Duluth made this 8-foot wedding cake. And, well, we did the wedding ceremony actually about four times. Because we only allowed one wire service to be there. After that was done, we came back. I think we dashed off to have our wedding pictures done and made a short stop at WLS Barn Dance. I mean, we did a telephone thing with that. Then we came back, and they had to let all of the other news publications and wire services come in. And we had to do the ceremony three or four times, and mainly because I flubbed.
A few boys that are still overseas, I hope that you can all come home soon to as nice a feeling as I have here now. Every one of you deserves it, and I hope you find it.
It had to be you. It had to be you. I wandered around finally found the somebody who could make me be true, could make me be blue, and even be glad just to be sad thinking of you.
I've seen might never be me, might never be cross or try to be boss, but they wouldn't do.
For nobody else gave me a thrill with all your faults. I love you still.
Had to be you, wonderful you.
It had to be
you. This is Forever Ace. It's the seventh sortie. Final mission.
Although the war still raged in Europe and the Pacific, it was clear Allied forces would soon prevail. Hitler's offensive into Belgium in mid-December only created a bulge that General Eisenhower's forces pushed back into Germany by January. The Battle of the Bulge marked the Third Reich's last gasp. The bloodiest battles of the Pacific were still ahead in 1945. Imperial Japanese forces made suicide stands at Iwo Jima and Okinawa. But Nipponese sea and air power supremacy had long since ended, and plans for an Allied invasion of mainland Japan were being drawn up for 1946. But these battles would be fought by others. Many veterans of the early dark days of this world war were called home. Major Richard Bong was one of them. Sisters Jerry and Joy say for the first time since 1941, their parents could breathe a sigh of relief.
I think so. I think Mom was real glad when he was finally coming home to stay.
But at the same time, he had seen the new jet when he was back after breaking Rickenbacker's record, and he knew he had to fly that plane. And so that's what he...
He asked for it.
Yep, he did.
Mm-hmm. Marjorie Bong Drucker says her husband was an aggressive fighter and he knew the risks. He knew this was dangerous stuff, but that sense of danger shaped the way he looked at life.
Even though he never talked about being afraid in combat, there had to be in the back of his mind, especially when he sees his buddies not coming back. And he had close encounters. You know, he saw his good friend Tommy Lynch destroyed in the air. He came back with like 82 bullet holes in his plane. So there always has to be that underlying possibility that it could happen at any time, which means you really appreciate every day that you're here.
His great desire to fly was the reason Bong joined the Army Air Corps. His war service didn't end that desire, so he volunteered to test the newest technology in the air, fighter jets. Carl Bong writes in his book, Ace of Aces, that his brother was looking forward to being a test pilot of the revolutionary P-80 Shooting Star, which would take the Air Force and the United States into the jet age. But the Lockheed aircraft was plagued with design problems. It had crashed more than a dozen times, killing several pilots since it began flying the previous September. Carl Bong writes that his brother knew all that, but he also knew that the P-80 was the hottest thing in the air. In June 1945, he was transferred to the Lockheed base in Burbank. He flew 11 test flights, totaling more than 4 hours. On August 6th, just 4 days after another pilot was killed testing the Shooting Star, the 24-year-old Bong was about to take another flight. The night before, he told friends at a dinner party that he never worried about such things as crashes. He had written his old wingman Ralph Wandry about coming to Burbank and flying these jet fighters. So Wandry transferred from Perrin Air Force Base in Texas and headed west to Burbank.
Just as I was finishing saying goodbye to my buddies at Perrin Field, the news came over the radio that Dick had been killed. And that chopped things short, and after discussing it with my wife, I figured, well, I'll spend the rest of my life with her.
August 6, 1945 was the day the B-29 bomber Enola Gay left the Pacific Island Air Base on Tinian and dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Little Boy, the first atomic weapon used in war, killed about 80,000 people instantly. The secret weapon attracted front-page news, but in many cases it was below the headline of the death of U.S. Ace of Aces Richard Bong. Marjorie Bong seldom talked about hearing the news about her husband's death, but from the Bong video documentary, The Boy from Poplar, she said she remained bitter about how the word got out.
On that day, I was on the rooftop on this apartment, and I came down and heard this news on the radio. It seems today, you know, that when tragic news of this kind happens, they don't release the name, you know, pending next of kin notification. That didn't happen. I mean, it was just blatant there on the radio. And the Bong family heard about it the same way.
For years, she didn't talk about it. Bong Center Director Christabel Grant said she not only stopped talking to radio reporters, but she couldn't remember flying home from California to Superior for the funeral in the same church in which they were married just 6 months before. She told her she didn't remember any of those 3 days, not even the day they buried her husband at a cemetery near the Bong family farm. For 40 years, Marjorie Bong stayed away from Superior, never visiting. She returned to California, remarried, raised 2 beautiful daughters, and had a successful career in modeling and then publishing The Boxer Review, a magazine devoted to canines. She finally returned after her husband, Murray Drucker, passed away. Grant said she came back in 1985 for the christening of the mile-and-a-half-long bridge connecting Duluth and Superior, the Richard Ira Bong Memorial Bridge. In 1992, Marjorie Bong Drucker was asked to help raise money for a new idea, the Richard Bong World War II Heritage Center, which was first proposed for Poplar, but eventually built in nearby Superior.
This helped her come to terms with it, because I don't think any of us can avoid coming to terms with a great tragedy like that. I mean, in almost the same way, many of our World War II vets don't want to talk about their horrific experiences. And they're starting to now because they understand that it's really a healthier way to deal with it. I mean, so many of them have post-traumatic stress syndrome because they were not able to talk about it and discuss it. And that's essentially what Marge was going through. So I think that they, working on the Heritage Center, helped her start to think about her life with Dick again and examine it. And she was very quickly became a much sought-after keynote speaker around the country.
But even half a century after his death, Grant said it was still difficult for her to talk about that moment.
I can see her, just her whole body language tightens when she gets to that point of the presentation. And I would always smile brightly and encouragingly and nod. And she, you know, got to the stage in recent years where she was able to get through it. But it has been very, very painful. And a lot of it was her inability to deal with the grief and the shock of the way she heard it coming over the radio when she was lying, sunning herself on the roof of their apartment building. It was just a tremendous shock, and you might say she was traumatized.
What did that mean to her, being with him for that short amount of time?
I think a sense of what might have been in life ahead, and the sadness. And today she talks about the sadness of only having had 6 months together, and the great irony of having him brought home to keep him safe, removing him from the war theater because they felt that he was going to be sort of a target for the Japanese because he was so famous and he was the leading ace at the time. And then to have him die again, serving his country, but in a different way.
In Ace of Aces, Carl Bong wrote that shortly after noon on August 6th, his brother took off in a P-80 Shooting Star. The takeoff was normal, but moments later, puffs of black smoke were seen coming out of the tailpipe. A Lockheed mechanic watched the right wing tip when the Shooting Star was about 400 feet in the air. Mrs. George Zane watched as the malfunctioning jet headed toward her house. She watched Major Bong try to escape, one wing dipping followed by the other. She said he was fighting with the plane, first flying over telephone lines and then under high tension wires, desperately trying to avoid smashing into her neighborhood. He was able to angle the P-80 toward a nearby vacant lot. Now just 30 feet above the ground, an explosion shook Zane's neighborhood. She watched Bong jump out, holding both hands above his head. The last thing she saw was smoke sweeping over him. An investigation determined he had jettisoned his canopy and pulled the ripcord of his parachute, but he was far too low and it was far too late to save him. He did make it to the vacant lot. No one else was hurt from the crash. The Air Force ordered all P-80s undergo certain engineering modifications before flight tests resumed. The Shooting Star was grounded for less than a month. A final classified report by the Army Air Force's Office of Flying Safety concludes that a minor explosion in the jet's power plant caused the P-80 to lose power. There was no evidence of pilot error. Richard Bong was killed instantly when he struck the ground.
When I hear that serenade in blue, I'm somewhere in another world alone with you, sharing all the joys we used to know. Again, your face comes back to me, just like the theme of some forgotten melody in the album of my memory. Serenade. Small cafe, a crowded floor,
and as we dance the night away, I hear you say forevermore,
and then the song became a sigh, forevermore became goodbye.
But you remain in my heart, so should I go on whistling in the dark.
Serenade in blue.
are listening to Forever Ace. It's the last sortie, his legacy.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hail at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight o'er the ramparts we watch were so gallantly streaming, and the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still stirred,
was waving there.
Oh, say does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave?
On September 4th, 2002, on what would have been his 82nd birthday, the Richard Bong World War II Heritage Center opened on Superior's waterfront to the voices of the University of Wisconsin Barbershop Quartet singing the national anthem. Several hundred people crowded outside the center overlooking Superior Bay and Lake Superior, including VFWs from Poplar, Superior, and the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. Bong Board Chairman Brigadier General Ray Klosowski invited the crowd of dignitaries, citizens, and most of all, veterans to tour this new center.
On behalf of the Richard I. Bong World War II Heritage Center Board of Directors, it's my sincere pleasure to welcome you, each of you, to today's ribbon-cutting ceremony. This event will officially open the Bong Heritage Center to the public. Here's the flyover.
The center is built in the shape of an airplane hangar housing a P-38 Lightning fighter plane, which was painstakingly restored by the volunteers from the Air National Guard, complete with a hand-painted picture of his sweetheart and the name Marge on its nose. Like his wedding and his funeral, this opening, too, was carried live on the radio. This time it wasn't national link-ups, just the local public radio station. Douglas County Commissioner Keith Allen told the audience that much is owed to those who served in the Second World War, and much is owed to Major Bong.
Just think about all the untold lives he affected. Probably five generations, from his comrades to their children, the grandchildren, to the great-great-grandchildren.
80% of the $5 million to build and staff the Bong Heritage Center was raised privately. Its first director, Christabel Grant, said many of the donations came from veterans. Grant says the building gave Marjorie Bong Drucker a part of Richard back to her. A year later, on September 27th, 2003, she passed away.
I think every time we look at her picture, we remember a time when people were expected to be heroes and heroic. She reminds us that it wasn't just our fighter pilots, but it was their families, their sweethearts, the people on the home front. I mean, she does a wonderful job of reminding us who we are and who we were and the spirit that we have and the ability to continue being like that.
At the Poplar Cemetery, half a mile from the Bong Farm, next to a Medal of Honor stone, is a simple marker. It reads Richard Ira Bong, Major, 5th Air Force, September 24, 1920 to August 6, 1945, America's Ace of Aces. Joyce and Jerry Bong say people from all over the country still stop by and lay wreaths or leave little P-38 model airplanes at the grave of their brother.
I remember one guy that was a military person. He stopped at our place from on his way through from Michigan. He told us that every time he came through, he'd stop underneath the plane and just sit there for a while.
to stop and pay homage.
In her interview with Wisconsin Public Radio in 2001, Marjorie Bong Drucker said she knows most people, especially young people, have never heard of her late husband.
If it's taught in school, it's really revisionist history. It may not even be politically correct to talk about Richard shooting down 40 Japanese pilots. And we do our best. We all do our best. And I think this is the major premise of the Heritage Center.
But many young people do remember Richard Bong now. School children have field trips to what is now the Richard Bong Veterans Historical Center to honor all veterans. In 1999, the U.S. Air Force Academy Class of 2003 chose Major Bong as their class exemplar. Not long after that, Bong Drucker was invited to the Air Force Academy.
I remember at the first dinner that we had in this huge hall where there were, you know, like 1,000 cadets seated. And the first speaker who mentioned the class of 2003, this uproar from 1,000 students are on their feet yelling, Bong! You know, and I thought, we all looked at each other, what does that mean? What's going on? And then we discovered, you know, that really is their class motto. And, oh, they were such wonderful young people.
This is another part of Bong's legacy. Air Force Academy History Department Chairman Colonel Mark Wells says they use him as an example when they teach their cadets about this nation's heritage and values.
It's not a profound thing to say that a nation's military is a reflection of that nation's culture, society, and values. And so when you have somebody like Dick Bong comes from a small town who grew up around farm machinery or automobiles, and so you have in his generation a group of kids that actually find themselves in the South Pacific, but they're used to dealing independently and solving problems on a farm. Some of these kids could tinker and fix engines and adapt to a tough lifestyle in tents in the South Pacific. So, yeah, everything that he was as a youngster played into his success, you know, either to inspire others as his success grew, but I mean right down to the willingness to put himself in harm's way for the safety and security of others.
So more like a role model?
Absolutely. Well said. He's an exemplar and a role model, somebody who demonstrates the qualities of character, the courage, and the leadership that we all try to emulate. We have a responsibility, certainly in my department, to teach just at the purest sense heritage. But the point of heritage is to be role model and inspire people. And it suggests to some kid who doesn't look like Jack Armstrong, the all-American boy, you know, they all don't have to look like Steve Canyon. They come in all shapes and sizes, and you never know when your next steely-eyed Dick Bong's going to come from.
Another legacy is the Bong State Recreation Area, named after the Wisconsin hero whose stomping grounds was 400 miles north in Poplar. It's a peaceful place with hiking trails, a beach, and it's a good place to just watch birds. Park manager John Meyer says it's a bit of Americana.
Oh, I think this is an outstanding way to honor his name. I know he himself enjoyed going hunting when he was young, and so he would love the hunting on the property. He would love to see that there's still some air flight type related activities going on the property. But I'm sure growing up in Poplar, Wisconsin, pictures I've seen of him, he's been outdoors and enjoying being in the woods or working on his family's farm. I think he'd be very comfortable here.
And the hang glider fellow from Chicago who is visiting the Bong Rec area but didn't really know who Bong was? Edward Seaton likes the idea of naming the park after a war hero.
I think so. I think it shows, you know, how perhaps our society is honoring some of our heroes and doing it in a way that's not building more bombs and more aggressive whatever, you know. So I think honestly it's a beautiful way to give honor to those that have sacrificed, you know, to come out here and experience the freedom, the open skies. I think that's what America's all about.
His family and friends know Dick Bong didn't seek fame or fortune. As far as fortune goes, he made enough money to pay off the mortgage on the family farm for his parents when he was home on leave in 1944. That was enough. So even though it's surprising today an epic movie or best-selling trilogy about his adventures and heroics were never made, and that his name has faded to a few internet pages and obscure books, that would suit Bong just fine. Richard Bong's legacy isn't fame. He didn't like being a national hero, but he probably knew that fame was fleeting. Notoriety isn't a legacy, not one of substance anyway. Bong's legacy is history, but also it is about his country and the descendants of the people he served at a critical time in the nation's history. Finally, there is the disappearing legacy of his aging comrades from the jungles of New Guinea. Crew Chief Sergeant Elwood Barden said that was another lifetime ago.
It's kind of like a dream. It's a dream that you wouldn't give anything for having, but you wouldn't go back and do it again. We were patriotic. I see kids today when they sing a national anthem, they just stand there and slouch around, and that just kills me. I mean, to know that we have such a country as we have may not be the best, but it's better than anything else you could find.
60 years later, in a 2002 interview, Barden says he can still see the face of the 22-year-old country boy from northern Wisconsin.
He just looked like a baby kid when he come and got in that airplane. I mean, he's, of course, you know, it don't take you long to get old over there.
Elwood Barden last saw his pilot, Richard Bong, at a war bond rally in Mobile, Alabama. In 2002, he left Alabama to be at the opening of the Bong Heritage Center. He said he wouldn't miss it.
It was important to me. I mean, I still cry. It was an experience, and he's a great hero. And I loved him.
Forever Ace, the Richard Bong story, was written and produced by Wisconsin Public Radio reporter Mike Simonson and was narrated by Jim Packard. Reporting help was provided by Wisconsin Public Radio reporters Tarina Beatty, Nick Pelletier, Danielle Kading, Chuck Wormbach, and Shemaine Mills. Editing assistance and consultation provided by Dominic P. Papatola and Christabel Grant. Other assistance from Colonel Jeffrey Williams of the Johnson Space Center, U.S. Air Force Staff Sergeant Gerald Sonny Perkovich, Carl Bong and his book America's Ace of Aces, The Richard Bong Story, The Complete History of World War II by Anne Woodward Miller, Bong Heritage Center Director Robert Furman, Bong Center Board Director Terry Lundberg, Stan Turner, State Senator Bob Jauch, Paul Guggenheimer, Lou Martin, and Masahito Watanabe. Forever Ace is dedicated to the memory of Daniel Simonson and Edward Manthey, fathers who led by example with dignity. I'm Jennifer Simonson. We leave you with this last vignette, a fun remembrance of America's Ace of Aces.
Dick Bong may have been a church choir boy who preferred soft drinks to hard drinks, but the guy was a character. He liked to play. From his early days of training in San Francisco, he'd buzz people and places in his P-38 Lightning. He buzzed San Francisco's Market Street and nearby Oakland, knocking clothes from the line of a miffed housewife. For that, his boss, General George Kinney, called him on the carpet, told him about the complaint he got from the housewife, and ordered him to report to the woman's house for duty. That included hanging laundry out on the line, mowing her lawn while the laundry was drying, and then taking in the dry clothes for her. He buzzed Milwaukee, he buzzed downtown Superior, and Duluthian John Hoff remembers when he buzzed the Duluth Harbor and downtown. Hoff was 12 years old, looking out the window of the Allworth building in downtown Duluth toward the aerial lift bridge.
I'm standing there all alone in the back of the office staring over the harbor, and all of a sudden I see this airplane rise from the water. Bong had apparently been coming across the harbor right on the deck, and that's where they used to fly during World War II to avoid detection. It was coming right straight at me, turned a little bit to the west. Now keep in mind, I'm on the 8th floor. The medical arts building is on the 12th floor. His wings tipped, and he slid below the medical arts building and disappeared up over the hill.
At about 400 miles an hour, Hoff says if you blink, you missed it.
And then I walked back in the office, and I said, did you see that? And, of course, no one did because it was a split second. So then I'm back in the office again with my hands in my pocket just staring out over the water, and all of a sudden I see this plane just go zing and emerge from underneath the aerial bridge. and then he was gone again, just like that.
This wasn't a show. Bong wasn't doing it for a crowd or for attention. Hop says Bong was home playing with his favorite toy.
He was just buzzing around. He was here in town. We all knew he was here. It was the only P-38 Lightning, of course, in the Twin Ports. He was just out riding around. I just happened to be staring out over the water. If you weren't looking there, you wouldn't have seen it because you wouldn't have had time to. He was too low and he went too fast. But I didn't tell anyone except the people in the office. I didn't make any deal out of it. I said, he just flew under the burial bridge. I said, oh my gosh.
Like most 12-year-old boys in 1945, Major Richard Bong was Hoff's hero, and John Hoff got buzzed by his hero, Richard Bong. I'm Mike Simonson. Thanks for listening.
Grab your coat. Don't forget your hat, but leave your worries. Leave them on the doorstep. Life's sweet. Just direct your feet to the sun, sunny side of the street. Hop on that pitter pat. You know that happy tune is my step. Life's alright if you dig that beat on the sun, sunny side of the street. Used to walk in the shade with my blues on parade. What a drag, old man. Getting stuck in the shade, get hip. Don't be afraid. Move it on over. Kill yourself in the clover. Only hit for a cent. Who cares? Rich as Rockefeller.